Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCPR 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery. I'm Al Warren, and we've got Mr. Joe Goldberg here as my co-host today.
I'm in the house, basking in the glow of my book release.
Yeah, how's that going?
It's okay. It's okay. Can always sell more. I always want more reviews. I always sell a lot more. I always want a lot more reviews. But I appreciate the readership and what I've gotten. It's fun.
Reviews is a really hard thing. That's the toughest thing to get, because you can sell a lot of, if it's not paid for, if it's not, you know, net galleyed out by agents. It's tough to get people to actually sit down and do a review. It's not a simple thing, but it helps a lot, you know, because just the, and even if they give you a bad review, it helps.
Yeah, in fact, my newsletter's out for this month. That last section was basically reader reviews, and I send out the ones that I sell directly. A piece of paper pretty much says, you know, give me a review. You know, does that have to be a lot of words? It could be okay or a thumbs up or just a star. But, you know, we all read reviews. Yeah. So help out.
You got to start going to people's houses.
I tried that on Halloween. That didn't work. People ran. I came as an author. I came as you. And people slammed the door in my face.
Yeah. It's like, oh, no, not him. He's not an author. We don't call him. I'm not an author.
True crime. Run away.
Yeah. Yeah, it certainly is. Well, today we've got an author, and actually from, you know, one of my stomping grounds, actually. Seattle was an area for me for a long time. Went to UW, did all that sort of stuff. So let's bring in our author today, and he's got a new book called, I believe it's called The Eunuch. Charles H. Fisher, thank you for being here.
Happy to be here, Al. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, Charles, what can I say? This is certainly the book strikes out. Certainly something different. It's not what you normally see in today's thriller crime fiction world, it seems like. What led you down the road to write this book?
Well, for a time I was a graduate student at Harvard Divinity School, and not a very successful one, and very poor. I lived in one of the oldest boarding houses in Cambridge, Massachusetts. It was like $22 a week. I had a hot plate, one room, bathroom down the hall. It was a relatively miserable graduate student life. But I was taking a lot of interesting classes, both at the school and at the university. But I had a neighbor, a young woman who was doing a PhD in Assyriology. And that meant she was learning all these dead languages like Babylonian and Akkadian and Hebrew. And she was translating and studying ancient cuneiform texts from Mesopotamia. And through her, I became interested in the old culture of Babylon. And that was kind of the beginning. At some point when I was thinking about what to write for my first novel, and I thought I might do something historical, I was thinking about different periods in history, and then I kind of ended up unsettling on ancient Babylon, in part because I knew this, my friend, her name is Jenny Myers, who was studying Assyriology at Harvard, but also because of what that word Babylonian meant to me from my kind of Midwestern 20th century background. It was like this image of decadence and power and luxury and corruption. And I thought there might be something there.
Wow. I wonder. So let's get, first of all, let's talk about the premise of the book itself.
Well, the premise of the book is, I'll give you my quick elevator pitch. The Eunuch is an erotic tragedy based on forged translation of cuneiform tablets that were unearthed during the Iraq War of 2003. It's told from the point of view of a harem eunuch. His name is Nergal, and he's the harem scribe of Nebuchadnezzar II's harem, a harem that consists of over 300 wives, girlfriends, and concubines, and his job is to record the goings-on in the harem in this Babylonian court. Another aspect of the story is Babylon at this time is preparing for a war, an invasion of Judah. This is actual historical fact. And so Nergal is there on hand to observe all the events that lead up to this war. And so that's the general kind of context for the story.
So, Charles, did the idea of the story come to you first as I need to write something about Babylon? Babylonia, and or was there some historical facts that you said this? There's a story in here. I need to piece these together somehow.
Yeah, it was a combination. Good question. Combination of a number of things. When I first started to write my ambitions as a novelist, I made the mistake of writing about myself. I get nauseous just thinking about it.
Don't we all?
yeah, and everything I wrote was just terrible, full of cliche. Right. Because I was just writing about what's it like to be a poor graduate student who has a terrible love life. I mean, it was kind of pathetic. The results were not very good. So what I was looking for some sort of analog, a persona or a mask where I could talk about some of those issues, but do it in a kind of a slant way. And so I hit upon this idea of a harem eunuch as a kind of alter ego for my miserable life as a loveless graduate student. I should also add, I wanted to write, I had aspirations to write a comic novel. So I was looking for a premise that I could mine for laughs, dark laughs to be sure. And so the harem eunuch thing was there in place. And then when the United States invaded Iraq in March of 2003, that got my attention. And I was thinking, you never know the consequences of these things. It sounded like a good idea at the time, but often these wars have a habit of turning out badly. And so then this idea of Babylon kind of gelled, because then I could write about a powerful empire, an imperium, as it were, possibly on the decline, maybe not, who's about to launch a war. We have no idea what the consequences are going to be like. And so I said, well, I know Babylon invaded, and from my years as a Sunday school student studying the Bible, I knew that Babylon invaded Judah in the 6th century BCE, and that, went really badly for the Jews. It ended up in the Babylonian captivity. I said, okay, so I'm going to set my harem eunuch in the kingdom of Babylon, and it all kind of lined up, the eunuch, Babylon, harem. These were all like analogies for my own situation. And then I didn't really have to write directly about myself. I could do it all kind of in code. And once I had that premise, I knew that I had something worth pursuing. But it took, 10 years really to execute, because it required a tremendous amount of research. And also, I didn't know how to write a novel. Thought I did, but I did not. And that took a lot of work to figure out all the various things that you need to know to write a novel. and, you know, to have it kind of work out as a story. So it was a long process, but it was very engaging and something I enjoyed tremendously, despite the fact that it took a long time to accomplish.
Oh, Charles, you have a lot of things in there I scribbled down for questions and notes. Let's start with, first one was themes. There are themes underneath this, obviously. There's the personal individual themes that somebody can see themselves in your characters, even though they're a thousand.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
It's years old, but there's also universal themes of society that also apply to us, like the aging big empire.
Yeah.
So that was your point, right? That's how you would put pieces together.
Yeah, you're going to have the particular and the universal, the individual and the state, right? I'm on the tail end of the baby boom, right? And so I was too young to, be drafted for Vietnam. But I certainly remember watching all that stuff on TV and then going through the 70s, kind of the aftermath, the hangover from Vietnam, right, with Watergate, You know, when we bugged out of Saigon in 75, those images of 1970s America were kind of imprinted on my mind. And so when the United States, you know, got jacked up for war after 9/11, it was, you know, as Yogi Berra says, it was deja vu all over again. And I had a very skeptical take on that war. And so that was kind of going on. And then I had my own kind of, you know, penurious existence as a minor academic, you know, essentially poor and powerless. And so, again, I was looking for a way to kind of talk about that in a way that would be more interesting. And so hence the eunuch and this giant empire on the eve of making this disastrous international decision. And so that, so I was fueled both as an individual trying to tell a very loose version of my own story, but within the larger kind of political and economic context of post 9/11 the United States.
So did you have something you wanted to get across to a reader? Like when you were you writing it for the reader as well? Was there something you hoped that they would pick up from this?
Well, that's a really good question. Initially, I wanted to write the novel that I wanted to read. The idea that I was writing for myself as a reader. And there were a number of books that I have deeply loved over the years, you know, a handful of these. And I wanted to give myself as the reader of my novel, but also other readers that same experience that I had, for example, when, you know, I read I, Claudius by Robert Graves or Lolita by Nabokov or Wolf Hall by Hilary Mantel. I was dreaming big, obviously, and, you know, I don't pretend to the genius of these books, but, you know, I was swinging for the fences to kind of create this reader experience. And in regards to like ideas or themes, I didn't want to be overtly political, although I knew that I had a hot political topic on my hand. Above all, I wanted to have a really good prose style, and I wanted it to be funny. I wanted it to be dark. I wanted it to be provocative. And I guess above all, kind of interesting. And of course, themes and ideas are there, but you know, every reader is going to take something different from that experience. I didn't want to be too didactic, right? I didn't want to preach. I wanted to have enough complexity and ambiguity in the situation to open it up to multiple interpretations, because the narrator of the novel is no innocent, you know, flower either. He may be a slave, he may be powerless, but he's got his own ego and his own will to power and his own agenda that he's working as well. And so I wanted to, you know, implicate him in the corruption as much as, you know, the state that he was and the king that he was writing about.
Well, was that main character you?
Well, sort of, but no. It was he's a scribe. He's part of the scribal class, and Babylon is 6th century Babylon is on the tail end of this very long culture that began with Sumeria and the 6th century BCE. And these are the guys that, you know, built the first cities, invented writing. They weren't the only ones to invent writing. You had the Indus River Valley civilizations and the Mayans in South America and, of course, Egypt. But they, in this area, they invented writing. They created this giant administrative, bureaucratic, scribal class. And I was writing about them, too. I was a very minor and insignificant part of that class. But nevertheless, I was there. And one of the things that kind of appalled me about Iraq was the total sign-off on that war by the so-called scribal classes of the U.S. Not all of them, but most of them. I'm thinking of the New York Times, the Washington Post, all the major outlets of journalism. And these are the, you know, the New York Times are the ones that published the Pentagon Papers, right? They were. And you had the Washington Post, of course, that began the exposure of Nixon and Watergate. And again, I consider myself kind of politically in the middle, even apolitical at times. I don't have a conservative or a progressive axe to grind, but I was kind of struck on how the establishment got behind Iraq, the scribal classes, as it were. And I think part of it was just the shock and horror after the atrocities of 9/11. So that was in my mind, the ways that the intelligentsia, as it were, could get on board and become complicit our foreign policy adventures abroad. So that was there, kind of.
How do you get in the mind or get behind the characters that you write?
Yeah.
How do you interact with your characters? How's that?
Right. That's a good question. So one of the ways I've thought about, so the novel's narrated, it's a first person novel, right? And so anytime you write first person, there are great opportunities, but there are also limitations and challenges, right? For example, you can't get in the mind of other characters. If you're writing from like a person, omniscient point of view, and I'm thinking of a great historical novel, War and Peace by Tolstoy, right? Believe it or not, that's considered a historical novel because he's writing the novel in the 1860s and he's looking back at like 1804, 1805. He's looking back at his father and grandfather's generation. Well, this is third person omniscience, and you see the thoughts and the mind and the feelings of every character. And there are dozens and dozens of characters in that novel. It's a great novel. But when you write from first person, it's really this singular point of view, and really the reader has only access to the narrator's consciousness, his or her thoughts and feelings about other people. So the first person narration is tremendously unreliable. He's going to purport to tell the truth and be objective, right? But, you know, he's got his own biases and his own, you know, political and individual axes to grind, right? They're going to color and shape his point of view of the world. So that's part of getting into that voice, a way to dramatize that unreliability so that a reader who's paying attention can see the cracks, the slight cracks and the gaps in the narrative edifice. But the guy who's telling the story, the narrator, doesn't see that. He thinks he's, you know, I'm giving you the unvarnished truth here, right? So you got to kind of figure out a way to kind of project that kind of confidence, that egotism. I think there's a kind of an inherent narcissism when we tell our own stories, right? Even when we're confessing to our own sins, as it were, or confessing to our own faults and our own mistakes and weaknesses, even that can have a kind of agenda to it. So it was really kind of trying to figure out that. Now, as far as getting the voice, a lot of it is I began by borrowing and stealing the voices of other narrators that I really admired and aspired to emulate. And so I'm stealing from Nabokov, you know, I'm giving my really bad imitation of Nabokov, or I'm doing my kind of garage band version of John Updike or Philip Roth. So I think I'm imitating these guys, but I'm nowhere near them. As writers. And so the thing is, if you imitate someone badly, it's going to come off as your own voice. And so I did that long enough, and sooner or later I kind of cobbled together something that I thought was original. And, you know, I mean, the novel's not perfect, and I could come up with criticisms of the book, but I think that one of the most successful things about the eunuch is the voice of Nurgle, the narrator. And I'm proud of that. But that took a while to kind of figure out. You're like an actor. You're inhabiting a role. And it has to look real and feel real. I don't know if I answered your question or not.
Yeah, no, that's exactly it. Yes.
Well, let's go with that. You inhabited the character, and actors, you know, they practice, they research. Just what were the layers of research that had to go into creating a fictional, historical fictional, 6,000-year-old
right
story?
Yeah, so I basically got the bibliography, put together a bibliography, a reading list on Assyriology, right, on the cultures of Sumeria and Assyria, Babylon, etc. A lot of it's scholarly stuff, right? But I could only do it in translation. I don't know Akkadian or Babylonian, right? So, and moreover, I could only do it in English. And so there's a tremendous amount of scholarly material on these cultures. Much of it's in German, much of it's in French. And so I was limited to just the English stuff, right? And on that reading list, there were probably, you know, 25 books or so. And, you know, I spent quite a bit of time in all of those. I had to know the gods, who the gods were and what they did. I understand the entire kind of mythology of Mesopotamia. It's quite different than something you'd find in Greece or Rome. Not totally dissimilar, but you know the names are different, the language is different. I had to kind of get a hold of the names. The names are so strange in this culture. Enkidu, Gilgamesh, just to name two of the most famous names in this literature.
Well, I think that's the name of Joe's kids, isn't it?
Yeah. I can't pronounce them. They just stay over there. Then I can't call.
It'd be a good name for cats.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So and I had to figure out, you know, what the religion was like, what the politics was like, all of that. And so it's kind of like brick by brick, you put it together. And the world build, I guess they call it world building. That didn't happen overnight. That took a couple of years and some revision. And I would just continually add to it. The more that I learned, the more that I could add. And I had to do it in a light way. It didn't have to be, I didn't want it to be too heavy handed, but it had to be plausible. I had to create the illusion or the veneer of historical accuracy. That required some work.
I have to say that. So when you first were getting this original idea, when you were first developing this thought of doing a book like this, to now, to where you are now, and now that it's published, did it turn out how you first envisioned it would?
Yeah, it's a good question. Yeah. So what was the vision? Yeah, you kind of have like this platonic ideal or some archetype in your head that you're always working for, and it's not fully articulated. It was more of a feeling, right? It was an idea and it was a feeling, and I didn't know what it would look like when it was done. And I would say that I got really close to executing on the vision, whatever its flaws are, and I'm sure there are a number of flaws in the book, both like historically and maybe even from like the point of view of art. But as far as my ideals as a reader, I got really close. I think I probably got like 95% of it, what I hoped it would be. And I tell my writing students that when you're thinking about writing, it swing for the fences, be ambitious, dream big. You don't know what you're capable of accomplishing until you try it. And I'm typically a fairly pessimistic person, and I don't always take that advice in my own life. But in this one instance, that kind of platitude, right, you know, swing for the fences, be ambitious, it actually kind of turned out, and it surprised me. The novel turned out better than I thought it would.
Well, that's good.
You know, I say that, with a certain amount of humility. I'm not saying it's a great novel, but it was better than I thought I could do.
An author should say that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's great. This is quite a process. This took quite a few years. And
yeah.
And you go through a lot to get to this. And even going through the characters and going through and creating their voices and what you want them to do and where you want it to go. So going through this whole process at the end of it, how do you think this has changed you?
Good question. Probably a number of different ways. I think that anytime you have an ambitious project that you conceive and then spend a long time working on, and particularly if you're setting your standards high and you execute and accomplish and finish that project, there's a certain amount of just like satisfaction there, right? I didn't abandon it. I didn't quit. And that could have easily happened at a number of times in the process. It's not an unfinished novel sitting in my drawer. And I know a number of people who've got unfinished manuscripts sitting in their drawer. And I've, you know, subsequently I've tried to write other books, start other projects. And I've got two or three projects that just didn't go anywhere after I wrote The Eunuch. Then I realized, oh, it's actually hard to find an idea that has enough legs that you can stick with and finish, right? I finally did find a second project that I've stuck with. But, you know, only after abandoning two or three things, just, you know, where the writing's bad, it's going nowhere, right? And so I realized, oh, you know, I don't want to say lightning struck, but it is a certain amount of serendipity, a certain amount of grace that has to happen for you able to kind of finish a project, because, you know, a lot of things don't succeed, don't work out. So that's a lesson I think I took away from that, to be thankful that I was able to finish that, whatever the quality of the end product is, at least it's done.
Charles, were there sections of the book as you're writing that you found more difficult to write outside of the research, just the
knowledge. Yeah.
Just things you like, oh, I don't know if the readers will like this, or tell me about those pieces.
Oh my God. Yeah. The middle of a novel is impossible. I had a writing teacher said that, know what your end is going to be, right? Figure out what the conclusion, the last chapter, last dramatic event, whatever, and then write towards that. So I had an idea of how the novel was going to end, or at least I had an idea. I conceived of the novel, there's three acts to it, and I knew how act two was going to end, and I knew that the third act was going to be 50 to 100 pages. I wasn't worried about that. But it was getting through that second act, the big fat middle. It was a nightmare. I took wrong turns, went down blind alleys with the story, couldn't quite figure it out. And I probably spent 4 years mired in the middle of that book, maybe longer. And it wasn't until I kind of cracked that second section that, finally. And then I wrote the last 100 pages really, really quickly. I wrote the beginning pretty quickly. I wrote the end pretty quickly. But that middle was very difficult for me.
Why do you think that was?
Well, because I hadn't really figured out the story, all the things that happened. I mean, the novel has like 22, 23 chapters. Each chapter is anywhere from 10 to 20 pages long, right? And so what's difficult is getting the chapters to hold together. So it's one thing to write a paragraph. The way I tell my students is you have to learn how to write a sentence, all the things that go in a good sentence. And then you have to learn how to write a paragraph. A paragraph is made up of a bunch of really good sentences. A chapter is made up of a bunch of really good paragraphs. And the first time you finish a chapter, it's like, oh my God, miracle, I got something that has a beginning and a middle and an end. It's working. It's good. I think it's pretty good. Right? But the real difficulty is once you have a bunch of chapters, getting them to fit together. That's like madness. And the only kind of analog to this is when you hear about musicians when they are trying to create an album and they've got, 10 to 18 songs, 10 to 20 songs. Well, which songs are going to go in there and what order do they go to try to kind of create this kind of holistic, coherent vision, right? And I just remember the story from Guns N' Roses on like their album Chinese Democracy. Notoriously, it took like 30 years for that thing to come out because Axl couldn't figure out which songs to go on the album and in what order. He was constantly moving around and playing with them and was never satisfied. There's something like that, at least for me, in writing that middle section. I had all these parts and I couldn't make them work together. Maybe it was just, I'm a slow learner, or maybe it was my first book, but for whatever the reason it was, that was the challenge for me.
Well, thinking from the point of view of the reader, was there some content that you put in there and you went, yeah, they're going to like this, or ooh, I better put that in. That's,
oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Did you cancel yourself?
I never canceled.
Or just say, screw it. I'm putting this in here.
Yeah, sure. Right. When I was writing this, I spent, the decade of the 90s in an English graduate school. Right. So all the kind of politics that are on our landscape right now, the kind of various progressive politics on our landscape, now we're there in seed, all of it, right? So I was aware of the various ideological toes that I could step on, particularly when I was writing about sex and power and gender, right? It's a minefield, right? And so one of the decisions I made was, I'm a man, right? I'm a heterosexual man. And, for my generation to write about sexuality and women, well, it's now seen as problematic. I knew that I couldn't compete with the so-called big swinging literary dicks of my father's generation, the Philip Roths and the Norman Mailers, right? There's no way I could compete with those guys, right? The work would be viewed as problematic and sexist and et cetera, right? And so I was aware of that particular minefield. So I said, I'm gonna try to do an end around that. I'm gonna create this being who's in the middle between male and female, and he's seemingly innocent of the, heteronormative dynamics that my fellow graduate students would deplore. And so that was one of my solutions, right? But on the other hand, so, even though he's been, even though his sexual organs have been eliminated, he's still full of desire. And so when he's in the harem and he's around all these young, nubile, beautiful women, he feels a tremendous amount of desire, but he can't act upon it, right? So in many ways, the novel is about thwarted male desire. But I masked it. I masked that potentially politically hot topic through the lens of this eunuch slave scribe. So there was that. And there were a couple of chapters that had some real kind of cringy violence in them. And I knew that some readers wouldn't like that. But I basically said, screw it. I like it. I'm going to put it in there.
I was going to ask about that, like the violence or the, you know, there's tension on each page, right? So,
yeah.
But you just kind of went with what would fit the story more than.
Yeah, well, part of it was I was a big fan of Cormac McCarthy's Blood Meridian. And I would challenge any reader to find a gorier and more violent book than that. Maybe the Iliad, right? It's a book about war, and it's tremendously poetic and profound. But there's an atrocity, a war crime, almost on every other page. And many readers can't read Blood Meridian because of their own sensitivities to violence, right? Which I understand, and I'm sympathetic to that. And I certainly didn't write Blood Meridian, but there are moments in the novel that are very violent and dangerous. For example, at one point in the novel, a minister in the king's court who's fallen out of favor politically is skinned alive before a live audience. This is something that these guys did in Mesopotamia. They were brutal in their war methods. Defeat an army or raise a city, they'd go in there and they would skin their enemy soldiers alive. And often they would nail the skins to trees or walls as a testament to the power and might of the king. So you've got, these are war crimes, atrocities, this kind of barbarism, this brutality, right? And so, to be accurate to that world, I wanted to portray some of that. But, so I did.
Were you cautious on how you detailed it? But, like, there's one thing of talking about skinning someone alive and nailing it. But there's also, you can kind of get into
the details,
the smells do you kind of subtly do that, or did you get right into that too?
First draft, I went for it. First, second draft, told everything, all of it. Showed the actual cutting of the flesh, the peeling of the flesh. Showed the shuddering and gasps of the victim, talked about the blood, the smell. Eventually this guy gets disemboweled and then you smell the urine and the feces. I did all of that. And my wife, who was my first reader, was so repulsed by that. And then when I gave it to my my publisher and editor, he just says, no way, there's no way you can do that. And so I cut all that stuff back, pulled a lot of it out. Right. And, kept as much as I could keep in that would satisfy my wife, although I don't think my wife was ever satisfied with it. But my publisher allowed it. I took their advice on that. But.
Well, you could have had an X version,
Yeah, man. I wanted to keep it in there, but, I don't know.
His wife is now heavily armed. Sleeps with one eye open.
Right. Yeah. So that's one example, but there are others. There's also how to deal with how to portray sex in a way. It's a comic novel, so I was always having to do it through that satirical eye. It is Babylon, after all. And Babylon, as an archetype, is a center of unbridled desire and lust and orgies and right. It's an image of decadence. And so, I had to tackle that subject as well and try to find a way to handle it and not make too much of a fool of myself. So there was a challenge in that for sure.
Well, let's go with that. You've gone from skinning someone alive to comic novel. Tell me, how did you portray why a comic novel and how did you portray the comic elements of it inside this book?
Yeah. So by comic, I mean it in a very broad sense. It's dark comedy. It's black comedy. Something on the order of the television show Veep, right? What's his name? Aaron Nucci, who wrote about the Washington politics. And it's dark and absurd, and most of the characters are unlikable. In my youth and early middle age, I liked black comedy, both in film but also in literature. So there's that aspect of it. It's not like I wasn't writing, P.G. Woodhouse kind of ha, ha, ha funny. So there's more of a darker element to it. And then, and it's not just all, I wanted to have a number of different narrative or emotional tones to it. So it's not all comedy. I would say it's more of a comic tragedy. And there are moments of seriousness there and earnestness within the novel. It's not at all just this kind of scathing mockery of the situation. And I think that was one of the things, one of the areas in which I would, to use the word I don't like to use too much, it's an area that I grew in as a writer. When I first started out writing, I just wanted to do pure satire, pure comedy, kind of keep that distance emotionally from the material. But as I was writing the eunuch, the original black comedy and satire broadened out and became more three-dimensional. There are moments of earnestness there, and maybe even lyricism, and certainly moments of tragedy. So there's more than one tone to it. But I would characterize the book as a comedy, a dark comedy, but still a comedy.
So it's more about, you know, the timing of the humor has to be just right in a case like that.
Yeah, you have to know when to deploy it and when not to. And I relied on my readers to do that. So as I was writing the novel, I had two or three readers that I trusted that were willing to take looks at chapters or certain sections and then give me honest feedback. And so I listened to what they have had to say. And at one point, there was just too much satire, too much kind of, you know, comic negativity to it. This is the reader that eventually became my editor and publisher. He says, you know, you need to move beyond that. I'm happy to read 70 pages of this, but no one wants to read 200 or 300 pages with this kind of attitude. And that was maybe some of the best advice that I got. And so then I began to kind of expand the scope of my narrative palette, so to speak.
Right, right. Story of my life. Now, what is your influences that surround you in not just other books, but just in general? Do you have certain things you draw off of in life?
Other than books?
Yeah, other than books. Or you can use books too, but if that's all there is. But I was just wondering if there's other things as well.
Well, I would say that the primary influences are certainly in books, and not just limited to literature, not just limited to other novels. There was a book written in the 17th century, published in 1630, called The Anatomy of Melancholy by Robert Burton. It's the first kind of in-depth study of what we would call depression. And it's about, 1,500 pages long. And I certainly have not read the whole thing, but I read chunks of that, and I found that really interesting. Some of the language I borrowed and stole from that. I was influenced by Shakespeare. I was teaching Homer and Shakespeare at the time that I wrote the book, reading the great tragedies, the four great tragedies, and the Iliad. And that certainly had an influence on me. Some of the kind of the larger, the thing about Shakespeare and Homer, they were actually philosophical writers. There's a lot of metaphysics and epistemology and ethics in their work. And I was a philosophy undergraduate. And so I was influenced in how these writers dealt with those philosophical topics, like the problem of evil, problem of pain, right. Homer, of course, war and power, the role that resentment and anger can play in an individual's life. The Iliad is all about the anger of Achilles, the rage of Achilles. And one of the things I've discovered as I've gotten older, it's very easy to become angrier as you get older.
Yeah. It's more fun too.
Yeah. It's more fun. There's an adrenaline there, right? And of course, our so much of our media, landscape runs on the gasoline of political indignation, left and right, center. And so the narrator of my novel has a tremendous amount of rage at his condition, right? He was enslaved and then castrated by this imperial empire, right? And forced to live a life of subservience. But he has to repress all that rage and mask it and hide it. And so I was interested in the role that plays and how he presents himself to the audience, because he's full of all this rage and resentment, but he doesn't want to appear that way. And a lot of it's not even aware of. So I was looking for a way to kind of talk about that resentment, that rage, that impotence that he feels. And his impotence is not just sexual, it's economic and political and, and also within the larger social hierarchy. And so I was very much interested in exploring those issues and themes. And those are themes like from my own life, of course, and then from what I see around me, what I've observed around me.
Yeah, marriage.
You've got marriage. You've got work, right? Right. Your so-called profession, or my so-called profession, which is tremendously hierarchical and full of status, and these power plays.
Wow. But it overall theme, it's still kind of, how would you consider it? A positive book or?
Yeah, right. Yeah, so I would say there's a certain amount of pessimism to the book, but there's humor in the pessimism. Hopefully there's art in the pessimism, right? And I think anytime that you have art and laughter, that's positive.
I'll write that one down.
So the content or the theme might be negative, but the experience of the reader, I mean, I want the reader to feel delight and pleasure, right, in the reading of some of these darker and more pessimistic themes, right? And if I did my job well and succeeded, hopefully the reader will feel delight and pleasure, and to me that's positive.
It's almost like laughing at the absurdity of life, of the things we go through.
You have to laugh or you will despair. And cry, right? Cry in despair, right? And there's plenty of that. It's an attempt. You could call it cope, right? Right, a form of cope.
Yeah, it's a way of getting through, you know.
Yeah, right. Consolation.
Yeah. Oh, it's interesting. The whole project. How do you see following yourself with something after this?
Yeah. Well, thanks for asking that question. Yeah, I eventually did find another idea for a book, another topic, and it's not entirely unrelated. I've spent the last 20 years teaching at a community college in Snohomish County, which is just north of King County and where Seattle is. And most of my students I would characterize as, I mean, I got out of the middle, kind of upper middle class bubble of Seattle. And most of my students are first generation college students. Many of them are working class or lower middle class. And something that I noticed about my students, and the men in particular, that there was a certain kind of melancholy or listlessness or lack of engagement, particularly amongst the young men. And I was trying to figure out, well, where are they coming from? Because I'm trying to teach them enjoy the humanities and, you know, read poetry and novels and look at paintings and find some connection with art. And I was trying to figure out, like, where are these guys coming from? And so I started to research some of the darker corners of the internet, and I came upon an image board that has, you know, has been in and out of the media over the last couple of years. And that image board is called 4chan, and it's where mostly young men, many of them who identify themselves as incels, kind of post and talk about their life situation, as it were. And so I spent about 3 or 4 years kind of researching and on that image board, I'd say 2015 to 2018, 2019. And during those days, there was a certain, the guys who came on there, even though they would post about some of the most deplorable things, for example, they would celebrate mass shooters. I once found a thread where these guys were comparing videos. They were comparing execution videos. These are real execution videos of ISIS in the Middle East, in Iraq, formerly Iraq, and various Mexican cartels. And they would get into these discussions, who's more badass, ISIS or a Mexican cartel? And they would compare these videos. Now, I never watched the videos. I wouldn't click on something like that. But I was fascinated that this conversation was going on amongst teenagers, amongst young 20-something. Right. And I don't have any children, but I would be horrified to have my sons on this kind of thing. And I know a number of my students that are at least aware of 4chan if they're not on it. And so I wanted to write a novel from the point of view of one of these 4chan posters. And part of the attraction of that is that they write in this kind of internet language, a memeified language, taken mostly out of Urban Dictionary. They made up their own kind of idiolect. Dialect, kind of subcultural dialect, and that language is now pervaded much of the mainstream. And so there was this kind of happy marriage between the language and this kind of nihilistic world that these guys inhabit. And so I thought there might be something there for a novel. I wanted to do my version of Anthony Burgess's A Clockwork Orange.
Well, certainly. Certainly. I've had some shows on that subject. And, of course, well, they're not allowed to. It's hard to get them posted because most platforms will ban it. Anything to do with it, even YouTube, like anything to do with 4chan or 8chan or any of that.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's the kind of the heart of darkness, right? But it's perceived as the heart of darkness. While I don't agree with much of their politics, I sympathize with these guys. Young men, there's a crisis of masculinity, masculinity in America right now, or at least I see it amongst my students, right? And there's a lot of real despair there. Many of these guys are suicidal and see no future for themselves.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It has to be recognized. You know, we have to.
I think so.
Yeah, it's not a great feeling knowing that they're watching videos or they're into that sort of thing. But it still has to be recognized and dealt with.
Yeah, this is the world that we've created for them.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, yeah, us as individuals.
No, I'm thinking you.
Yeah.
I know. But I'll tell you, this is where technology has brought us. It's given us the internet. While there's a tremendous amount of good and power in the internet, it's also all sorts of bad stuff there as well. It's had all sorts of consequences that we had no idea would happen when it first came online, 1995 or whatever that was.
Yeah. Yeah. It's amazing. Amazing. Well, listen, how do people get a hold of you? If you like people, do you like them to interact with you, readers and stuff like that? And if you do, you know, you have social media platforms, website, let's give out your details and they can get a hold of you.
Yeah, well, I have a website. It's charleshfisher.com, all one word, F-I-S-C-H-E-R. And then I'm on Twitter also at cfisher2.
Well, fantastic. Of course, now we'll have that up on our website so people can find you if they can't remember it, and it'll be easily done. So, you know, it's been a great conversation. Enjoyed having you here. Of course, the book is called The Eunuch, and our guest is the author of that book, Charles H. Fisher. So thank you for being here.
Thank you, Al. I certainly enjoyed it.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.